The closest museum and gardens is a rebuilt French monastery in Fort Tryon Park near the northernmost tip of Manhattan. It also happens to be the highest point in Manhattan. It's celebrating its 75th anniversary this year with a series of special exhibitions, and the current one, which ends this Sunday, is called Search for the Unicorn. It features what may be the best-known pieces in the Cloisters collection, the Unicorn Tapestries, along with a number of other artifacts and paintings related to them. Timothy Husband, curator at the Department of Medieval Art and the Cloisters of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, joins us now to talk about the exhibit and the history of the Cloisters, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
How many Unicorn Tapestries are part of this exhibit?
Only one of the series is the Unicorn in Captivity.
But the other tapestries are not part of a series originally made as part of an original series?
Well, that's a complicated question. The series, as we think of it, probably was not made as a coherent single series. But what we have consists of elements of three or four different series, all focused on the unicorn and all commissioned by the same person.
Where were they originally found?
Well, they appeared in the 19th century at the Chateau de Fréteuil, which belonged to the La Rochefoucauld family. And in the 1920s, I believe the then seigneur had decided he was in need of funds to build a private golf course. So he sent the unicorn tapestries to New York, where they were offered for sale.
Had they always been treasured?
Well, they were very little known until they were offered for sale, and then overnight they became very famous.
The La Rochefoucauld family of the famous writer?
Correct, yes.
They have been considered extremely valuable pieces of art now, but you're saying they weren't always valued all that much?
Well, we know from records during the Revolution that they were used to protect potatoes in the cellar, so they were not treated quite as well as we treat them.
Those lucky potatoes. How much are they worth today? Anybody done an estimate?
Oh, it would be impossible to make an estimate. They're unique. Nothing of the sort has ever come on the market.
And there are nothing. There's nothing like this elsewhere in the world?
Well, there's another series of the unicorns in the Musée de Cluny in Paris. But they're very different. Ours have to do with the hunt of the unicorn. The ones in Paris are an allegory of the senses.
And what do art historians believe the image of the unicorn signified for people in medieval times?
Well, it had varied meanings. Some viewed it as a Christological symbol. Others viewed it in a secular context as a symbol of fidelity and marriage.
Although they don't seem to fit in with any Christian ideas.
No, but the unicorn in captivity at the Cloisters, where the unicorn is sort of enclosed in this little fence bound to a pomegranate tree, seems to have wounds on its flesh. And following the previous tapestry where the unicorn is killed, he's sort of, in some schools, considered a symbol of the resurrection.
Where were unicorns believed to live?
Deep
in the forest, sacred mountains?
Well, unicorns existed in the mythology of many different cultures, not only in Europe, but in Africa and the Middle East. And the writers usually thought, because they could witness they didn't exist in Europe, if it was a European writer, they assumed they lived in the Middle East, whereas Middle Eastern authors assume they must live in Europe because they're not there. So they were wherever you were not, basically.
So are all of the tapestries that relate to the unicorn on exhibit owned by the collection?
Yes, yes.
Is it a challenge keeping these things from deteriorating?
Well, it is.
You can't just vacuum them like you would a rug.
No, they actually do get vacuumed, but far more gently than we would vacuum a rug in our home. They're maintained by our textile conservation staff on a regular basis. The most difficult thing about them is the silk content, which gives them that rich, lustrous quality. But silk desiccates and just disappears. It's dust if you're not careful. So keeping the relative humidity at the right level is very important.
What about the colors? They are shown, they're just hung on the wall, no covering,
Hung on the wall, no covering, but the light, which is the real danger here, is very carefully controlled. They're all exhibited under 5-foot candle of light, and that's considered a safe light level. And they're brilliantly preserved, so, I mean, I suppose
those potatoes probably helped.
Well, indeed, they were in a dark cellar.
Although they had eyes looking at them all the time. The entwined letters A and E are woven into the corners of the tapestries. What's that supposed to represent?
Well, that would be the cipher of the person who commissioned them, but unfortunately we've never been able to identify. It may have been the first and the last letter of a name, such as Anne, which was one theory. Anne of Brittany was a theory at one point, but we just don't know.
We're talking about the 75th anniversary exhibition at the Cloisters with Timothy Husband, who's curator at the Department of Medieval Art and the Cloisters at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Now, this collection is really a collection of the Metropolitan Museum.
It is.
And if the Cloisters had not been built or rebuilt up in Fort Tryon Park, then they would have had to jam all of this stuff into the Metz building on Fifth Avenue?
Well, yes, but when the Cloisters opened in 1938, the collections were far smaller than they are now. We've added to the collections continually since the museum opened, largely through the beneficence of John D. Rockefeller Jr., who left us an endowment.
Was he an art collector?
Well, yes and no. He was very interested in Chinese porcelains and seriously collected those. He never collected medieval art.
Although he did own the unicorn tapestries. Or he bought them for the museum?
No, he bought them for himself. They were hung in his house on 54th Street. And he clearly loved them because he didn't give them up easily.
Well, everybody loves them. They are just...
Well, they're irresistible.
They're beautiful. Yeah. They're not only wonderful works of art, but they also have a wonderful mystery to them.
They do. Being the most famous series on the globe, it's really surprising how very little we know about them.
And would you say they're the most famous pieces in the Cloisters? There's also a very great triptych by a man who used to be called the Master of Flamal.
Well, it's now attributed to Robert Campin and his workshop.
And I guess those are equally famous. Are they the two things that would draw tourists to the Cloisters?
Those, but there are other great masterpieces, too. There's the very famous Romanesque ivory cross, the English Romanesque ivory cross, formerly known as the Bury St. Edmund's cross. There's the... This Belzer, the Book of Hours that was commissioned by Jean de France, the Duke of Berry, and is one of the most magnificent manuscripts to come down from the Middle Ages. So we have no lack of great masterpieces.
And then you have the building itself. How did that come to be transported from France to Fort Tryon Park?
Now, the building itself was built as a museum in the late 30s, but it was built around the elements of 5 cloisters, which had originally been at the Barnard Cloister, which was farther down on Fort Washington Avenue.
Because there's another important person in the story, George Gray Barnard.
Indeed.
He was a Barnard College?
I don't think there's any connection there, no.
But he was a friend of Rockefeller's?
I wouldn't say he was a friend. He was a longtime acquaintance and sort of a nemesis, really. There was sort of... a grudging admiration on Rockefeller's part for Barnard, but he found him extremely exasperating and almost impossible to deal with.
Still, it's good that both of them got involved.
Well, it was Rockefeller's public-spiritedness and Barnard's need for money that made it all work.
And then it was put in what is now Fort Tryon Park?
Yes. Rockefeller's interest in that part of Manhattan originally was for – what was then known as the Washington Heights. And it consisted of three large estates and was at the time, just before the First World War, the last large parcel of land in Manhattan with no cross streets, avenues, and high-rise buildings. And Rockefeller wanted to preserve that as a park.
Also, it has a magnificent view of the Hudson River.
It does indeed, and of the Palisades on the west bank of the Hudson.
So has the building pretty much remained the same over 75 years?
It has, with the sole exception of the addition of the apse from Fuente Dueña.
The original cloisters of Barnett's collection were kept intact and integrated into the design. Is this just all new construction?
Yes, it's totally new. Well, 1930s construction.
Uh-huh.
And the intent was to comfortably incorporate these architectural elements into the fabric of a modern museum building.
And there's also a garden?
There are splendid gardens, yes. There are gardens within each of the main cloisters. Cuxa Cloisters, which is the central and the largest of them, is divided in the typical manner of quadrants, garths, and is centered around a series of each quadrant on a crabapple tree and beautiful ornamental plantings, whereas Bonifaux on the lower level is much more historical. And in there we have 250 species of plants that are documented before 1525.
So you're kind of keeping them alive. Even if they go extinct elsewhere, they're kept alive at the cloisters.
Yes. Well, of course, species constantly sort of self-hybridize. So what a simple rose looked in the 15th century, we know secondarily from manuscript illumination, but genetically what we have today is not precisely the same.
Now, this exhibit runs through this coming Sunday.
Yes.
What happens to the tapestries, and is there another exhibit coming in to replace it?
Well, the unicorn in captivity will return to the Hall of the Unicorn Tapestries.
So we'll still be able to see it?
Oh, yes, yes.
Won't be able to see it in this enlarged version, which explains an awful lot.
Exactly. The little exhibition will be gone. But starting on the 10th of September, we have another exhibition. This actually is more or less of a performance piece called the 40-part motet, which is probably the most famous work by the Canadian artist Janet Cardiff. And it is based on the music of the Tudor composer Sir Thomas Tallis. And the work, the motet, is In No Other I Place My Faith, and it is sung by the choir of Salisbury Cathedral in England. And the idea is that it's a 40-voiced choir, and there'll be a speaker for each of those voices. And so as a visitor, you can go up to one speaker and hear that individual voice. The voices are arranged in groups, eight groups of five, so you can step back and hear a group of five, or if you step in the middle, you hear the entire ensemble. Normally, Janet Cardiff mounts this work in a neutral, modern architectural space, but we're doing it in the Fuente Dueña apse. The apse itself is the 12th century apse that was brought over block by block, and then its forehall is based on the dimensions of the original. And like all of these Romanesque apse, they were intended to project sound. So we're all very excited to see how this works. It's the first contemporary work of art we've ever installed at the cloisters.
Well, you have had other musical presentations.
We have a major program of music and have for many years.
Well, the cloisters are often described as one of New York's greatest treasures, and yet it's my sense that foreign visitors, tourists, are much more likely to go to the cloisters than New Yorkers. Has that been your experience?
Indeed it is. The foreign visitation of the cloisters is huge. I think it's more than 40% are foreign.
And why do you think that is? New Yorkers just take it for granted?
Well, I don't really know. In the case of a lot of our visitors are French. They know of it in large part because it consists of many monuments that were once theirs. So they have kind of a vested interest in coming and seeing it. But Then one of the largest groups are Brazilians. I don't know particularly why the Brazilians are so taken with the cloisters.
But Brazilian tourism is up. We just heard a report this morning on Morning Edition about how many Brazilians are coming to New York and Miami. Luckily, many of them to the cloisters. And you have until Sunday, Brazilian or not, to see Search for the Unicorn at the cloisters. We have a slideshow on our show page. My great thanks to Timothy Husband, curator in the Department of Medieval Art and the cloisters at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.